F1A. Number 15A.
We come to the next prophet that we could read a short text to Habakkuk. Habakkuk means love's embrace. And the story he is telling, the prophecy, is very simple. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. He calls himself a prophet. He's the only one among the 16 prophets who calls himself to be a prophet. And the message is the following. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? So he is again quarreling with his God and said, how long shall I cry and you don't answer, you don't hear, you don't seem to move? A question that we may have also very often in our heart, that we say, how long will it take until I get out of trouble, until the situation clears up, until the storm is over? How long do I cry and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. So he begins to see that there is all over the world violence, and God doesn't move, does not interfere. The same question as people have today, they say, well, I don't believe anymore in God. How could a God tolerate all that is going on in the way of cruelty, hunger, terrorism, and so on? There is no God. And thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that rise up strife and contention. Therefore, the law is shaken. It says, the law of God is shaken. I don't believe that God is a law. And judgment does never go forth. For the wicked does compass about the righteous. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth. He sees that the law is wrong, that wrong judgment proceedeth, that there is no law in the country, and so the law is slack, and judgment does never go forth. You can hear that he is thinking about the law of mind, says, is God really the law of mind? I can't see that there is a law at work. Everything seems to be the very opposite. Then we come to a next section from 5 onward. Behold, ye among the heathen, and regard, and wonder marvelously. For I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I rise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. You see what he is saying? He says he can see that the Chaldeans, an enemy of Israel, will just come up and march through the nation, march through Israel and through the breadth of the land to possess their dwelling places. They will be conquered, that he can see. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. He gives again a very good picture of how the Chaldeans, the foreign nation, will come like leopards, like wolves, that they are swift, that they come, you can't stop them, they enter the city, they enter the land with their horses. That was always a great danger for the Israelites because they didn't have horses nor chariots. And so they always felt that the other nations were much stronger, they were much better armed. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. So they will gather the Israelites like the dust of the sea, like the dust of the sand, and take them away. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be scorn unto them. Naturally, here again, it is about the Israelites, about the kings and the princes of Israel and Judah. So they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold. Every fortified city in Israel will be taken. For they shall heap dust and take it. They shall heap dust, meaning they just heap up the ground up on the walls until they can march on top of the wall and enter the city. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. Again, he changes the side and talks about the Chaldeans. So here he shows something again, namely that Habakkuk just sees that the enemy, that evil, is much more successful than good. That nothing can stop really the enemy. They come and possess the land. So he has another contention against the Lord, the second one. The first one was that he saw that the law of God was broken. Here in the second one, he sees that the enemy, the evil, is much stronger than good, so that evil can overcome good. So that's the picture he sees. Perhaps I should have said what was the historical situation at his time. After Nahum has prophesied that really Nineveh would fall, it actually happened, namely Assyria fell. And so when Assyria fell, naturally the power of Assyria in Judah was broken. But the moment Judah was left to itself and was weak, then another big nation entered in. So the Egyptians came in. They conquered Judah. So they were again under the suzerainty of a foreign nation. Then when the Egyptians were in Judah, then the Babylonians took the place of the Assyrians. And the Babylonians fought Egypt and conquered Egypt. So Egypt had to withdraw, and so now the Babylonians entered in. And that was then the time when Judah had to go into Babylonian captivity. So this is political, military situation at that time. So the prophet Habakkuk just could see that always the others, the Chaldeans, that's another name for the Babylonians, that always the other nation would enter in and the Lord would never defend Israel. And so he said, is that the law? Is that the God? He couldn't see that really the God of Israel would be anything. He just always could see here first that the law was broken, that the law was not kept, that false judgment was given, and so on. And the second one, that evil was always more powerful, was always conquering good, and so he didn't believe anymore that God is good and would conquer evil. And now he comes to a third contention he has against God, namely the tone of soul. Verse 12. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, mine Holy One. He queries, said, are you not the God Almighty? Are not the God of Israel? Are not the God, the Lord, my God, from everlasting, the Holy One? We shall not die. Wasn't that the promise of his God? O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and Almighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and hold aside tongue, when the wicked devours a man that is more righteous than he? Can you see the reproach he has? He says, well, you were told that you are the Holy One of Israel, and that you should never die. But the very opposite happens. Why? And you were told that you could not see evil, that your eyes were of purer eyes than to behold evil. Why then do you look at evil? Why then do you not interfere? Why do you see then how they deal treacherously with us? Why do you hold your tongue? Why don't you voice your voice? That is not the right thing. Why don't you say anything? Why don't you interfere? Why do you let all this happen? 14. And makest men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. He says, we are really like fish in the sea. Everybody can come and just put out the nets and take all the fishes in the nets and carry them away and eat them up. You treat us that way. 15. They take up all of them with the angle. They catch them in their net and gather them in their drag. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. Can you see the reproach he has? He says, why are you willing to not to interfere? You can't you see that your people, to whom you have promised that it shall never die, why do you let us die this way? We are like little fish and they just hook us up and eat them and that's all. They had a beautiful language to teach things. Therefore, they sacrifice unto their net. They sacrifice not God, they sacrifice the net with which they catch us. And burn incense unto their drag. That's what they do. They have idols, the net and the angle and so on. Because by them their portion is fat, and their meat plenteous. They have everything. We don't have anything. They have everything. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? See, he compares even whole nations, how these big powers just conquered one little kingdom after the other. They were always a lot of little kingdoms, the kingdoms of the Edom, of the Midianites, and so on. I always say and so on when I don't know the names anymore. And you say and so on. But as I said, at that time they had 22 little kingdoms in their pocket, and they did with those kingdoms just what they want to do. And Judah and Israel were one of those kingdoms. Those kings were never free. You see, we always forget that in the time of the prophets, Israel and Judah were never really free countries. They had kings, and they had their queens and their princes, but they were always tributary to the big powers. Yes. These things happen today also. So that's the third contention, that he really could see with the third question, well, that he could see that God is actually not interested in his people. Not at all. In, These are the three great questions that Habakkuk put forward. These are the three great questions which we hear today all over the world. People bring up these three contentions against God. They say, well, there is so much unrighteousness going on, so much corruption going on, so much treacherous activity going on. Is there a God? Why does he not interfere? There is so much evil being stronger than good, and evil always having the upper hand, always being victorious over the good. Is there a God? There can't be a God. And the third contention always is, well, is there a God? Why doesn't he move? Why doesn't he interfere? Why doesn't he translate it right down to us where we are and see that things are straightened out rightly? Why doesn't God interfere? Why does he let wars go on, hunger go on, terrorism, etc., etc., go on? Why doesn't he do anything? Aren't these three big questions? And it seems that the world hasn't changed very much in those 2,500 years. Nor has really the mentality of the people changed very much. Habakkuk here only voices what he has heard in the land, what the Israelites were saying in the land, why they turned away from Jehovah, why they went after other gods, why they worshipped idols, and so on. He could see that these three questions were never really answered. So he himself had to find an answer, or else he would not have been a prophet. So after the first three stages of mind, spirit, soul, we usually come to the fourth, where the solution is introduced. In most cases in the prophets, we always have in mind, spirit, soul, the proposition laid down without giving a solution. And then with the fourth, usually, it is either with the fourth or with the sixth, that then the solution is introduced. Here, he introduced the solution. We come to principle with chapter 2. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me. He is the Lord. What he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. So he more or less says that up to this point where he had his three contentions against the Lord, that he apparently was not on the watch, that he was asleep, that he did not look out from a tower, from a high standpoint, that he apparently looked out from the testimony of the physical senses, and that those first three questions were all questions that were based on the testimony of the five physical senses. For the five physical senses, he could only see that there is no law of God at work, that evil is mightier than good, and third, that God doesn't care two hoots about the people. He is way up and rests there on the skies and in the clouds, up in the clouds, and he doesn't care what's going on down here. That's from the physical standpoint, or from the standpoint of the physical senses. Not so is it when he says, but I will stand upon my watch and set me up on the tower, and I take a higher standpoint. When I go up to the standpoint of God and look out from there and will watch to see what he will say. Up to this point, Habakkuk was saying what Habakkuk was thinking, or what the human mind was thinking, and not what the divine mind was knowing. So he said, well, let's change the standpoint. The standpoint from the personal eye to the divine eye, standpoint from human thinking to the divine vision. Let's change the standpoint. And when we change the standpoint, then we will see a different universe. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, and he may run that readeth it. This is an interesting passage, which in various Bible translation has various renderings, but whatever the rendering is, they always have the same meaning. And what is that meaning? The Lord said and answered and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables. So he said, interpret now what you can see when you stand on the tower. When you look out, how the Lord looks out. How principle looks at the universe, and not as your personal sense looks at the universe. And interpret it and write it down so that he may run that readeth it. This is translated sometimes as saying that it is written so plainly that even those who run by the tablets can read it and it's understandable to them. Others put it another way and say that it is written so clearly and so impressively that you can't help but go and do it and run and do it. That it triggers off such a power, such an impulse that you go and do it. Whatever the reading is, it means more or less the same. It shows that the vision from the Lord is very clear, very understandable, even though you just look at it quickly. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. Said it's for an appointed time. It's not quite now. But at the end, it shall speak and not lie. So he said, this takes time. It takes unfoldment. You have to wait. Something first has to change in your consciousness. Your standpoint, your new standpoint, demands quite a lot to look out from God, and that demands some doing, that demands some culturing. But the vision is, but the end of the vision is true, and it shall not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it. Says, though it tarry, he appeals to to patience, and it appeals to be consistent and not to give in, to tarry, to wait, to be not to get slack at it, and wait for it, because it will surely come. It's certain. The vision is certain. It will surely come. It will not tarry. Now suddenly it will not tarry. First it says, I will tarry, and now surely it will come, it will not tarry. The moment the development within ourselves has come to the right point, it demonstrates itself. Now you can see that within those two verses, 2 and 3, you have, so to say, a positive resume of mind, spirit, soul. As if he would like to say, look here, when you look out from principle, then you must see from principle what mind sees, what spirit does, and what soul accomplishes, and not your personal point of view, which you had in the first three subjects. Again, let's see. In point 2, and the Lord answered me and said, write the vision. See, write the vision. Vision is mind. Mind has a vision. Mind is that intelligence which has a vision. That's very different than what Habakkuk was saying in the first tone, that he says, I can only see that the law is slack. That is no vision. That's a personal opinion. So from the point of view, from principle, we only see the law of mind at work. So write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. Then comes a tone of spirit, for the vision is yet for an appointed time. It must develop. You must give it time. You must give it a chance to unfold and to evolve. But at the end it shall speak and not lie. The language of spirit will be clear and will be truthful. Then you have a tone of soul, though it tarry at first, wait for it. You have the persistency of soul. Soul is persistent, does not give in, does not go back, but is persistent. Wait for it, because it will surely come. The certainty of soul, it will surely come. It will not tarry. Now in the same verse it says it will tarry and then it will not tarry. Do you see how one has to read this always spiritually? From a literal point of view, this is contradictory. From a spiritual point of view, it's beautiful. It says, well, though it tarry, well, then you have to persist and persist in it and not give in and not go back and go forward, and then it will surely come, and then it will not tarry. Once something begins to crystallize, like in chemistry, something begins to crystallize, the true form of the crystal comes right out. But before that, there is something going on in the chemical process. Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him. Says, look here, now we come to a tone of principle here. Principle as principle, and says, you see, the one really whose soul is lifted up is not upright in him. The personal sense that is lifted up, that will not do the job. You will not be able to interpret what's going on in the world, what is really acting in the world, what is really operating in the world, if you are just lifting up your own personal view. You know, that's what you always hear. Now that politics plays such a big part in the world, you always hear everybody says, according to what I think, to my view, to my opinion. Well, who cares? Who cares about anybody's opinion? We shouldn't care about anybody's opinion. That is, behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him. A personal opinion is not worth anything. So he says, you should have another. You should have the opinion of God of the tower to look out from principle. What is, in principle, the right thing to do?